On The Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is The Murder Squad. The village of Oak Park lies 10 miles west of Chicago. But for its residents, it feels like it's a world away. In 1984, a 24-year-old woman went for her evening walk through the neighborhood. That woman never made it back to her apartment.
Word of the attacks whirled around the village. The case became the obsession of a local teen named Michelle McNamara. It is a case that first brought Michelle into the world of true crime. And despite a possible connection to other attacks in the area, it remains unsolved. Our job, to find the killer of Kathy Lombardo.
This is The Murder Squad.
My God, Billy, it's actually hot out here in Colorado. What's it like out there?
It is hot here as well. I'm not looking forward to it. I got a hockey game coming up in 3 hours, and there was an excessive heat warning in Burbank, I saw. So,
at least you'll be on the ice, right? So,
no, this is roller. Unfortunately, this is roller in the sun, so it's not going to be
good. Oh, that's going to be tough. Yeah,
it's not going to be good. But anyway, so you know, we usually do an update at the beginning, but this is a really big episode, and we want to get to it right away. So we're going to go right now to Oak Park, Illinois. 24-year-old Kathleen Mary Kathy Lombardo lived in the village her whole life. She had been a musical child, studying ballet, tap dance, and piano. She was an honor student at Trinity High School. She worked at a bookstore while she attended Quincy College. In the summer of 1984, she was a department store clerk at Marshall Field. She shared a Washington Avenue apartment with a roommate less than a mile away from the home in which she grew up. Those who knew her described her as sweet, quiet, shy. She had a passion for walking, and actually thought about becoming a mail carrier. A brisk walk around her Oak Park neighborhood became her nightly routine and made her a familiar presence in the community. The evening of Wednesday, August 1st, 1984 was no different. Unusually hot, maybe. After all, it was the peak of summer. But it was business as usual as Kathy left her apartment to walk her usual route.
She set out at around 7:30 p.m. Her walk took her to Euclid Avenue near the White Hen Pantry and the Oak Park Green Line Station, and then on to Pleasant Street, where a trail was cut short. That's where an unknown assailant grabbed her from her path on Pleasant Street and dragged her into the gangway. Cloaked by the total darkness of the alleyway, he raped her, stabbed her in the heart, and slashed her throat, leaving her to die beside some garbage cans. Some reports indicated that a broken kitchen knife or paring knife had been found nearby. Five teenage boys were on their way to the White Hen when they discovered Kathy's body. They had taken a shortcut through the alley. They called for help, but by the time help arrived, it was too late. Kathy was gone. Ronald Sermon was the first Oak Park police officer on the scene that day. He told the Chicago Tribune he looked at least at 100 tips on the case at the time. Witnesses who observed her remembered, according to the Tribune, seeing an unfamiliar male watching her intently. He appeared to be following her, trying to catch up with her. The suspect wore a yellow tank top, dark shorts, knee-length athletic socks, and a blue bandana. He was described as a medium to muscular, darkly complected black male between 25 and 30 years of age, and around 6 feet tall.
Word of Kathy's murder spread through the neighborhood that night, eventually reaching a household just 2 blocks away, where 14-year-old Michelle McNamara had been holed up in her writer's retreat, that is, her attic bedroom, enjoying those last few weeks of summer before her freshman year of high school. Michelle knew the Lombardo family from church, and she couldn't stop thinking about Kathy's murder. What gripped me was the specter of that question mark where the killer's face should be, Michelle wrote in I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Intrigued by the case, Michelle went to the alleyway just 2 days after the murder. She vividly recalled holding pieces of the yellow Walkman Kathy used during her walks. Local media coverage in the wake of Kathy's murder painted the picture of a virgin community whose innocence had been shattered. "Image of secure world is shaken by murder," one headline declared. The place where we live isn't a quiet little village anymore, said Jerome Schmidt, whose home abutted the alley where Kathy's body was found. A community meeting was held at St. Edmund's, the church frequented by both the Lombardo and McNamara families. The Oak Park police presided over the meeting, where they shifted the onus of responsibility to serve and protect onto the citizens, suggesting a stronger neighborhood watch effort. In the final analysis, the police chief editorialized to the Oak Park Oak Leaves, which is the newspaper there, "We really are each other's keepers. Somehow we failed the other night. I hope we don't fail again." And one particular message the police department kept pressing was that Kathy's murder was an isolated incident, a one-off.
But the seemingly peaceful suburb of Oak Park was in fact no stranger to stranger rapes. In 1976, a woman was raped while jogging through the nearby Thatcher Woods Forest Preserve. It was the first of a series which continued to 1978. Then five more women were sexually assaulted in the same preserve. In each case, the offender would confront a jogging victim with a knife or gun. Then he would force her into an underbrush, bind her hands, and rape her. To preserve control over his victim after he left the scene, he'd look at her ID and warn her not to go to the police. But before leaving the scene, he ordered his victims to count to 25 until they moved a muscle. This attacker was described as a light-skinned black male, 18 to 30 years old, 5'10 to 6 feet tall, with a slender but muscular build. He would reportedly dress in jogging clothes and sometimes wore rose-tinted glasses. But the police chief in neighboring River Forest disputed this description as media hype and claimed this specific rapist dressed in Levi's and cutoffs, not jogging clothes.
The next year, a series of similar sexual assaults on joggers took place along Washington Boulevard in Oak Park. It was just blocks away from where Kathy Lombardo was killed 5 years later. In fact, stranger rapes in Oak Park, and the village's lax response to them, became such a problem that in December 1979, dozens of local women formed a coalition called Oak Park Women United Against Rape. They staged a nighttime demonstration in front of the village hall. As a result, a whistle-stop crime prevention program was established. Whistles were distributed at community meetings, so citizens could blow into them if they witnessed or became victims of a crime. But armed robberies and rapes in the area continued. In October and December of 1982, four more women were raped while out walking or jogging in the same area. The descriptions of this attacker would prove nearly identical to the suspect in Kathy's rape and murder.
One of the 1982 victims was 15-year-old Grace Puccetti, who talks about her attack on a new episode of I'll Be Gone in the Dark that aired last week. The attack on Grace took place one block away from where Kathy was killed and one block away from where Michelle lived. The circumstances of Grace's attack and Kathy's murder were eerily similar. Both Grace and Kathy were attacked only steps away from their family homes. Grace had been cut in her neck by the attacker with a kitchen knife or steak knife. Grace's attack was the only one to receive any press coverage. It was a single entry in the Oak Leaves police blotter. The blotter described the crime as an aggravated battery and robbery, making no mention of the sexual assault. Michelle had reached out to Grace before her death in relation to her case and how it might tie back to Kathy's, but Grace wasn't ready to speak to her about her assault. Even over 20 years later, Michelle was still trying to solve Kathy's murder. That's around the time she teamed up with Paul Haynes, who worked with her on I'll Be Gone in the Dark, and along with Billy, co-executive produced the HBO docuseries. He's also the writer of today's episode.
So, hey, Paul.
Hey, Paul.
Hey, guys.
How's it going? You doing?
Good. How are you guys?
Good. We're good. So, on her blog, True Crime Diary, Michelle described her fascination with Kathy Lombardo's murder as her origin story. And I always consider it sort of like her Bruce Wayne moment. And we all have one of those cases that drives us. When did she first talk to you about that case, Paul, on top of, you having read it because you were a reader of the blog before you guys became partners in working on the book?
Yeah, I remember being very early on when we were getting to know each other via email. So this probably was back in 2011, 2012. And by that point, she'd already written the piece on her True Crime Diary blog about it. So I think it's something that, slowly she was reentering. And I think she first reached out to Dan and Terry a few years before she published that piece. So this is something that was long gestating for her.
What was it about it that really, you know, grabbed her?
Well, she was 14 years old when it occurred. And when something like that occurs in your neighborhood, it leaves an impression, especially if it's during your formative years. And I think that and her proximity to it and her memory of holding the broken shards of Kathy's Walkman, I think that was her entry point.
Paul Holes, you spoke with Michelle a bunch of times, but you had never talked about this case with her.
No, you know, this case, the Lombardo name sounds like something she brought up to me, but we never did a really deep discussion about this case. We were solely focused on California and the Golden State Killer.
Right. All right. So let's really dig into the crime scene. And we are going to talk about the fact that we don't have access to any of the reports. And that's going to become clear why. There has been a very interesting approach that you often see out of Illinois law enforcement, which we are going to be critical of when it comes to this case and also the other cases. But, you know, Paul Haynes, let's walk Paul Holes through this crime scene and what we can glean from it, what he might be able to pull out from it.
Sure. So what we know is that Kathy left her apartment around 7:30 p.m. And it must have been a long walk because it was around 9:30, 10 that she was confronted by this unknown individual who yanked her into the alleyway and found the darkest part of the alley, which I believe was beneath some lights that were busted or out. And certainly the lighting in alleyways in Oak Park had been a topic of discussion at community meetings both before and following this crime. He sexually assaulted her in this spot. At some point during the encounter, he stabbed her in the abdomen, piercing her heart, and he slashed her throat, and he fled the area. Now, curiously, he was described as having, by witnesses who spoke to police during the neighborhood canvas, as having been dressed like a jogger, wearing a yellow tank top, I think a blue bandana, knee-high athletic socks, jogging shorts. And given the bloody nature of the crime scene, it's remarkable that nobody witnessed anyone, either in the neighborhood, leaving the neighborhood, or on any of the public transit, any of the trains following the crime, who was wearing bloodied jogging clothes. What do you make of that, Paul?
You know. First, I think it's important to establish whether or not, if we know, was this a routine pattern that Kathy was doing? Was she walking along this path at the same time every night? Or was this just her moving, you know, she ended up choosing to walk along this path this particular night? And I'm not sure that's something that we know at this point. However,
I think, and Paul, you can confirm this, but she did have a routine that she did walk might not have been the exact route each time, but it was at least a similar route that she would walk, and she did it pretty regularly. So there definitely could have been every night. So This is somebody that, you know, and then it gets into, well, if this was somebody that continually watched her every night and then somehow saw his time to strike because he, you know, sees her going into that one particular alleyway. And I also want to clear up something, because when I first heard this when I first read it from Michelle, hearing the alleyway, I was thinking an alleyway like you think of in an urban town or something. This is really, you know, sort of like that road that's behind houses where people leave out their garbage and then where they can sometimes park.
Okay.
That's
we have the kind them here of in LA.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's just, it's sort of like, they're not really alleyway, kind of gangways kind of thing, but they're not really, you know, it's not like there's walls on either side and you're kind of, you know, stuck in one place like that. So
right. I believe the Grim Sleeper had disposed of some of his victims in suburban alleyways mm-hmm. like that.
Well, so, you know, with that routine, that's where it's like, okay, was she targeted versus was this a random attack? Was this a victim of opportunity? The fact that she does have a routine at least opens up the possibility that she was targeted. However, this style of crime, you know, and I liken this offender because I've seen multiple serial rapists as well as some killers out of my jurisdiction that employ this strategy. I liken this to a trapdoor spider. This is somebody who hides out in the bushes waiting for the right opportunity, the right victim to pass, and then pounces and then pulls that victim into his lair in order to do the sexual assault and or homicide. That's what this really sounds like. And generally, those types of offenders prey on the victim of opportunity. But I wouldn't discount with Kathy's routine that this potentially could have been targeted, but I kind of lean towards this may have been more of an opportunity. Now, his outfit is striking to me. It's hot out. You know, he's got the tank top, you know, what's being described as a jogging attire, but a yellow tank top. You know, this is something that doesn't appear to be dressed to try to blend into the shadows like these guys who are thinking ahead will do. You know, so that also tends to suggest that was he in the area, sees Kathy walking, and then is familiar enough with the area, ends up going into to where he can hide and wait until she passes by and pounce. So in taking a look at his attire, with witnesses saying that he's wearing a blue bandana, 1984 in the Chicago area, this would be typical of gangs that are affiliated with the Crips. And that would be something that I would be looking into if I were investigating this case.
Okay. Do you know if that was ever looked into, Paul Haynes?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. I mean, whenever I would think about this, the description of this character, he's wearing the sort of stereotypical jogging outfit or athletic outfit of the late 70s, early 80s. Knee-high socks, probably short shorts, a yellow tank top. And you're right, it's something that people are going to remember that person if they walk down. Now, that could also remember that people remember that person, but they don't remember the person that might be dressed in dark clothes that's sitting in a bush.
Right.
Yeah. So we don't necessarily know that this is actually, this could be the guy.
And wearing a yellow shirt, it doesn't sound like he was dressed to kill.
Right. Mm-hmm. So according to Kathy's brother, Chris, the Oak Park Police Department badgered the family for information in the weeks following the murder. And then just a few months into the investigation, they kind of threw up their hands and said, "We've exhausted all the leads." And according to the family, law enforcement said they were just giving up on the investigation. Kathy's mother died 5 years later, and the Oak Park PD have not been cooperative with the family, have not been cooperative with the media in the years since. But Michelle still wanted to investigate the case. So Michelle got in touch with everybody that she could, and that included Dan Olis and Terry Keating, who had been among those five boys who had discovered Kathy after the attack. And both revealed to Michelle that almost immediately after they found her, a tall Indian man appeared in the alleyway, and he had just come out of a nearby house. The man approached the boys and asked, "What's going on here?" And they told him somebody was hurt and they needed to call the police. The man said he didn't have a phone. He returned to his house, which was two doors down from where Kathy was killed. Now, Terry told Michelle, a childhood acquaintance who lived nearby, had also encountered the man on the night Kathy was killed. He remembered the man appearing in the alley. He was freshly showered as the cops processed the scene. And according to this acquaintance, the man asked, "What's going on here?" Now, this was a lead that had never been in the news or anything like that, Paul Haynes. We ended up calling this guy, and before we get into the call, which was probably one of the strangest calls I've ever done before in journalism, but that was a weird scene. But when Michelle told you about this and told you about, like, you know, being able to uncover that this guy that was there, and then, you know, with the shirt buttoned down to, you know, or opened at the navel, and freshly showered. What was she thinking about with this guy?
Oh, I think she found out suspicious, and certainly in the absence of any other suspects at the time, I was unaware of this suspect description, and I really didn't know much about the case aside from what Michelle had shared with me. And it also spoke to the value of someone like Michelle looking at this case with a fresh set of eyes and finding someone who should have been looked at in 1984. And I'm sure he was talked to, given his proximity to the crime scene. We know there was a neighborhood canvas. So,
You know what? I will say we're not quite sure because the police won't talk to us. So,
yeah.
And we've also heard, they neighborhood canvas. But sometimes if they neighborhood canvas and the people aren't there the one time that they knock, that's it. You know, so, and Paul, you've seen that before, Paul Holes, you know, it's just we did a neighborhood canvas, but, you know, so what was the course of events? We had gotten a phone number and we did this in 2019. We were at your apartment and we got the phone number, I believe, of his son.
That's right. We talked to the son and then somehow we obtained the number for the Indian man and
right.
We called the Indian man and the Indian man answered.
Right. So, one thing though, is that when we talked to the son was very cordial.
Yeah.
The son remembered the night. Obviously you're not going to forget a night where somebody is murdered two doors down from you. He remembered the night. He remembered his father was there. He remembered a lot of things that had happened that night. So we said, okay, thank you. And then we called the father and walk us through what that conversation was like.
I remember him being very hostile and suspicious from the outset. He wanted to know who we were. What did we tell him? Do you remember? Did we tell him who we were?
Oh, we told him who we were. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, we weren't approaching him from the context of you're someone of interest. He was simply someone in the neighborhood whose house abutted the alley where this crime took place. So it was just, you're a witness. What do you remember from that evening? He claimed he didn't remember a crime taking place in the alley behind his house. He had no memory of the murder. He continued to demand how he got his number. He was hostile throughout the call. And afterward, it was the sort of thing that made us go, But in retrospect, I would say, look, if that's the man's personality, if he's suspicious by nature, there was something in the son's tone as well that precipitated that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you detect that?
Yeah. I think that the strange thing was, is that you're not going to forget that. You're not going to forget somebody. And if we had just been on the phone with his son saying, I remember that. I remember my dad was there, placing his dad there and then talking to the dad and the dad telling us, I don't know what you're talking about. Now, if somebody calls me up, you know, if I'm not in this business, somebody calls me up out of the blue, I'm like, who is this? I would be suspicious as well.
Yeah.
But the thing that rang hinky with me was the fact that he said, I don't remember that. And that was not sort of like a, I don't remember that, just get off the phone. It was really just like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. I do not know what you're talking about. I don't remember anything like that happening. That was the thing that was strange.
Yeah. I always like to play devil's advocate in situations like this. And I think, you know, this was an older man in his 60s or 70s. I don't think he was originally from the United States. Some of those people just don't want to get involved. They don't want their names associated with something like this. And that may well have been where he was coming from. And that might also account for his behavior in the alleyway that night.
Yeah.
He wanted to get information, but he didn't want to get involved. And he was sort of lingering around. And when the kids asked to use his telephone, he claimed he didn't have one, which I'm sure was a lie. But he may have been suspicious of those kids and their motives. Perhaps he thought, they're the perpetrators. I don't want to let them in my house.
No, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. So, Paul, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, obviously, you know, what you guys experienced with this man, you know, his apparent lack of recollection of a homicide that occurred basically right outside his property. You know, that, of course, is going to cause me to go, well, what's going on here? I mean, supposedly there's witnesses that put him out there that night. This seems like something that he should remember. Now, of course, he has two individuals he doesn't know, you know, you and Paul, calling him up years later And he may be suspicious of that. He may be, you know, backtracking. So that is something that we have to consider. But it is interesting. And would somebody commit this style of homicide right outside their house?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are examples, and maybe a slightly different case, but not entirely. David Westerfield down in San Diego, where he abducted the little girl in his neighborhood and killed her and buried her under his house. You know, those types of things happen. Offenders will commit crimes near the residence. Sometimes the impulse is so strong that they throw out the concern for self-preservation in order to satisfy the impulses. So it's something that I wouldn't eliminate. I mean, but I think it also is less likely. It's not as common as what you see in this type of attack.
Yeah.
Thinking about the logistics of that, his address was, I think, four houses into the alleyway. So I'm thinking he would have to, I'm just imagining that evening, he's four or five houses down from the mouth of the alleyway, and that is perpendicular to Pleasant Street. So I just don't see him traveling, I don't know how many yards or meters that is, but it's a little bit of a distance, and just waiting for someone that he doesn't know whether or not this person's going to materialize, and then killing her and leaving her in the alleyway and then going back to his house. And his behavior afterward, if he is Kathy's killer, suggests a cunning and organized offender, whereas the crime itself doesn't. Am I wrong?
No, you know, I think that the type of offender that commits this attack is usually very unsophisticated. And to have somebody who is living nearby to commit this style of attack, who seems to have the wherewithal to be able to think ahead, have some forethought. This man most certainly would recognize the risk he has brought onto himself by committing this attack and then showing up afterwards, you know, and basically presenting himself to witnesses. That is contradictory to this particular person versus the type of offender that normally does what I call this trapdoor spider style of attack.
Yeah. And I think, you know, because of everything that you both were saying, and because that she had a pattern that she used every day, I think there is more of a chance that this was somebody that was either following her or knew that she was going to be coming along. Now, does that mean that they're necessarily organized? We know that they brought a weapon to the attack, and they did it in somewhere that was a dark area. But it could have been watching her for a long time, and the impulse just got there, and that's why it might have potentially been a little bit more disorganized. But
no, anytime you have a routine like that, you know, you have to consider somebody who is seeing that routine. And often it's going to be neighbors or other people who are commonly in the area.
It's a puzzle.
Yeah, definitely. So the man was not on the radar of the police at the time. And while some close to Kathy felt that she was killed by somebody in the neighborhood, the Oak Park authorities disagreed. Sermon told the Tribune he is 100% sure the killer is from Chicago, not somebody in the neighborhood going out right outside their house and raping and killing somebody. He was immediately saying that this is not somebody from our town. This is somebody. And then they identified the L, which is the subway, the above ground subway, saying that had to have come from over there, came in from the big bad city. This is not from our town. And really kind of deflecting and throwing it over the fence there. But there was also a question of whether Kathy's murder was related to the two earlier series in the Forest Preserve and on Washington Boulevard. And those were dots that not only Michelle was trying to connect, but retired Chicago homicide detective George Siebel was looking into. And Siebel believes all these series and Kathy Lombardo's murder are indeed the work of one offender, and he also believes that this offender is responsible for an earlier murder. So shortly after 9 in the morning on Sunday, May 28th, 1978, Rita Hopkinson, who is a 22-year-old medical student, was attacked at that Oak Park L train station. A man forced her up the entrance ramp, tore off her clothing, sexually assaulted her on the platform. Now, Kenneth Bobko, a 30-year-old postal employee, entered the station around this time. He saw Rita at the top of the stairs. She had no pants on and was pointing to an area on her periphery, which was out of Kenneth's view. Suddenly, a man popped out and stabbed Kenneth twice in the chest. And Kenneth fled down the stairs. He called out for Rita to follow him, but the attacker dragged her further into the station. The offender stabbed her 5 times in the chest, once in the groin. Kenneth lost consciousness, but he survived. Rita Hopkinson died. Rita's killer was described as a black male, 5'10", and a sketch was circulated and published in the local press, but the man was never identified, and Rita's murder remains unsolved. Now, Paul Haynes, you looked at this one a lot. What were you thinking with this and also with Grace's story, which was the, you know, one of the main stories on the new episode of All Be Gone in the Dark? They look very, very similar.
There are some eerie parallels between the Grace Puccetti attack and Kathy Lombardo's murder. I'm less sold on Rita Hopkinson. I mean, certainly the area, the fact that it's unsolved, the fact that she was stabbed to death during an attempted rape, those things are superficially similar to Lombardo's murder. But we know there were also other rapes in the area where the suspect description was similar, the MO was similar, and those individuals were identified and apprehended. So they're clearly, we have multiple offenders operating in the same area with a similar MO. I think, you know, we're all familiar with linkage blindness, which is a term coined by John Douglas to describe a tendency among investigators to not connect cases that should be connected. I think the inverse exists in the extracurricular investigative community, where there's, I would call it linkage mania, where there's an overzealous, where there's an overzealousness in connecting multiple cases that have superficial similarities but might not be connected. And this, for me, brings to mind, we had a guy back in the days of the A&E forums, who his theory was that Ted Kaczynski was the Golden State Killer, in addition to being the Zodiac Killer, in addition to being the Atlanta Child Killer, in addition to being the Chicago Tylenol Poisoner. All these cases, what they have in common is people were murdered. That's a very superficial similarity. So I think one needs to take care not to hastily link cases together just because there are two or more factors that are similar.
Yeah, as far as, and I completely understand, you know, anybody that's been on in a chat room, anybody that has been in the true crime community has seen this linkage mania. And as much as we have been critical of certain police departments with linkage blindness, we always bring up the Manson murders, you know, going from the Tate murders and the LaBianca murders, murders that happened a day apart, 13 miles away from each other, with blood written on the walls, and they said, no, these aren't connected. That was, yeah, okay. So, but then you have things like, you know, the thing that jumps out to me are like the smiley face murders, you know? So there's a young man, college age, found in water, that has to be a serial killer. And, you know, that's just, it's been something that has, you know, taken on a life of its own.
You know, in terms of addressing this linkage mania, I've used the term overlinkage, and I've personally seen this, in which, you know, multiple homicides were assumed to be committed by the same offender. And then ultimately, as these cases are solved, it turns out that it was multiple offenders committing the same type of crime on the same type of victim in the same type of area. And so that's where it's within law enforcement, linkage blindness absolutely occurs and overlinkage occurs. However, law enforcement has that more global view of having, you know, that direct access to all the information. And the overlinkage aspect is probably less likely than what you see in the online community because they are seeing the details and have experienced these cases and understand that these types of individuals are so much more prevalent than what the general public know. The amount of strange men out there is stunning. And that's where law enforcement is equipped to go, you know what? Even though we have the situation on the platform at the L where Rita and Kenneth were stabbed, and it's by somebody who matches the description of the suspect in the previous case, we know that it's very possible that could be two different offenders committing a similar type crime.
Yeah. You know, in the early days of my burgeoning interest in cold cases and serial killers, I had this book that I'm not going to name because it's actually a pretty poorly written book, so I don't want to plug it. But it was a collection of unsolved, well, still at large serial killers. And this was written in the late 90s. I kept a document with all of these cases and I would update it regularly whenever one of these cases would be solved. And there are series in this book that, as it turns out, four or five of maybe seven cases have subsequently been solved, and there were four or five separate offenders.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me at all. You know, and in this day and age, because, you know, of course, back in the day, and then all the people online can do is rely on circumstances, right? But as physical evidence is processed and as identifying evidence is used, DNA or latents, cases get solved. And that's where you start separating out some of these cases that appear to be done by the same offender. And you start realizing, holy smokes, you got the same kind of guy, but there's three of them operating in the same area at the same time.
And I think it's psychological, too, because nobody wants to, having one monster out there that we are all concentrating on and trying to fight, that's a hell of a lot more comforting than having 20 different monsters out there. But bottom line is that's what we've got. We've got 20 different monsters. I mean, we saw that with the I-5 killer. There are many different I-5 killers were there. The Killing Field, same thing down in Texas. Possibly Long Island serial killer. There might be multiple. So,
and then you have killers like Arthur Shawcross, whose MO and victim type change. Shawcross, I think, killed two children, one of whom was a boy. If I'm not mistaken, in the early 70s, and he served, I think, 15 years in prison. He was paroled, and then he killed a string of sex workers who were, some of whom were middle-aged. Mm-hmm. So there's a radically different victim type in those two pieces of his series.
Yeah. Rodney Alcala also had varying victims. Obviously, you know, Bundy didn't sort of until... It was, you know, the victims that we were all looking at for Bundy were similar type of victims. And then we learned there were a lot, there were other ones as well. So, and Boston Strangler is a perfect example of somebody. He would just knock on doors, Albert DeSalvo, and then it could have been a 80-year-old woman or it could have been a 16-year-old. You know, it didn't matter to him. You know.
The idea that serial offenders only choose a particular type of victim and always use the same MO is a myth. There's too many examples of these offenders doing different things, either because of evolution or because of the dynamics of the situation cause them to do different things. And they like to experiment. They also have fantasies that they are pursuing. And these fantasies change as they read different things. And they go, well, let me see if this will work. Do I like this? And they try it and it doesn't work. And then they go back to what they did before. So that's part of the complexity of only MO-based linkage or only circumstantial-based linkage. And there isn't, you know, you have experts such as in the FBI with their profilers who see nationwide these types of series, but there really isn't that human algorithm that you can sit there and go, okay, this is how I can sort this out. Because sometimes, no matter... you know, how similar everything looks, it could be two different guys who have the same type of desire and the same type of MO that they're employing. And that's what makes it hard. That's why you do have sometimes this overlinkage that occurs, as well as linkage blindness, where you're going, ah, it's got to be different guys. And it turns out it's one guy, but he's doing different things at different times.
So Rita's family eventually sued the Chicago Transit Authority for inadequate security at a platform that was known to be dangerous. And a jury sided with the family and awarded them $1.5 million. While these series and Kathy's murder went unsolved, there were multiple rapists with similar MOs operating in the Oak Park area in the late 70s and early 80s, and some of them were caught. In May of 1982, a woman was attacked at an Oak Park L train station. A subject pulled a knife and tried to rape her. Luckily, police happened upon the crime and thwarted it. A 28-year-old Chicago man named Anthony Ridley was arrested, and police discovered that he'd attacked another woman on Washington Boulevard only minutes earlier. However, whether or not Ridley was convicted and for how long he was sentenced never made the news. Also in November of 1982, a young woman was sexually assaulted while walking through an alleyway in Oak Park. Her attacker was found hiding in some bushes not far from the crime scene and arrested, 30-year-old Henry Carr Jr. He had been out on parole and was consequently sent back to prison for 20 years, so he obviously wasn't the same man who attacked Grace Buchetti the next month. So, you know what, as much as we are putting the Oak Park police feet to the flame, I have to take issue with the local media as well, because we were seeing stories of our community, our safe community, all of this, these things, and none of these stories were hitting the news. Not just that local newspaper, which was the Oak Park Leaves, but also, you know, where were, you know, and newspapers had a lot of money back then and had a lot of correspondence, especially in Chicago, where you had two very powerful newspapers in the Sun and the Chicago Tribune. You know, Paul, when you were doing research on this, were you finding a lot of stories in those old newspapers?
I was, and they were largely about the community's outrage over what they perceived to be indifference towards sexual assaults in their community. And this specifically is Oak Park. What I've noticed is that Cook County is lousy with unsolved cases, and Oak Park in particular. I was looking at the history of the last 40 years of murders in Oak Park, and Oak Park has only ever solved one cold case, and that was back in 2003. So any homicide in Oak Park that wasn't solved within the first year that it occurred would likely never be solved. But, you know, neighboring DuPage County looks like has a better track record with cold cases. So I think it really comes down to the culture of the individual agency. And it kind of reminds me, you ever see Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me?
I have, but I know Polly definitely has. She's a Twin Peaks fanatic, so.
Very much so.
So it opens in this town called Deer Meadow, where this girl named Teresa Banks is killed. And the FBI, it's Chris Isaac and Donald Sutherland. They go to the local Deer Meadow Police Department, and it's a complete opposite of the police department we've come to know and love from the town of Twin Peaks. And it's lured over by a man named Sheriff Cable, who stonewalls both agents. The Oak Park Police Department reminds me of the Deer Meadow Police Department in Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, is my point.
Well, you have to think that with such a lousy track record, you know, what did Einstein say? The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Why don't you start maybe using the press? And Paul, you were on a case that you were talking to the press and trying to utilize the press for a cold case. And, you know, because of that and because of your willingness to talk to different journalists and, you know, the case got bigger and bigger and was able to get more resources and you were able to bring in the FBI and everything like that and eventually get solved. What is the hesitancy that you've seen of different police departments?
Well, you know, it's so varied. And I can talk to personal experience in interacting with media. You know, when I was young, I was a line level forensic scientist and O.J. Simpson trial was going on. And they came into the lab to interview a forensic scientist about, you know, the technology that was being discussed at the trial. And I was interviewed by a TV news person. And I knew the questions he asked and I knew the answers I gave. And then when I watched the segment that I was on, I saw my answers being taken out of context versus the questions that they put out there, to the point to where they were erroneous. And I was going, you know, my peers within the forensic science world are going to think I'm just the biggest idiot in the world giving those answers to those questions when it wasn't even factual. So there is that element. I have been interviewed and provided information on cases to only see it either intentionally or just through not understanding being misportrayed within the print. So there is a little bit of a mistrust on that side. And this is where I have always been very friendly with the media, even after the bad experiences. But it's taken the time to properly communicate the issues to make sure that the person that is reporting it understands it. And if that person, and this is where Michelle shined, that person can truly write about, you know, what I'm talking about accurately. And if I happen to develop a trust like I did with Michelle and say, hey, here's something off the record, just so you know, this is what's going on, so you can understand the context of why I am saying the things I'm saying. And that person is able to hold the information that they've been given and not burn law enforcement, then you establish that trust. Progressive law enforcement agencies need to better use and do better use the media. I believe law enforcement can most certainly better utilize the media and be more transparent with the media. And then the media also has to understand when law enforcement has a need to not be transparent or to hold information back to preserve the integrity of the case.
I think as far as media goes, particularly in podcasts, because unlike in newspapers, if you were, you know, you did have a line of editors watching what you did, which was good because you did have a lot of checks and balances. But sometimes you would make mistakes and then you would do a correction. While, you know, today we don't necessarily have that in media the way that we had before, but we have the crowd, and the crowd will certainly tell you when you mess up. And they will certainly tell you, you didn't get this correct. And quite frankly, that's going to be, the crowd is going to be able to call out things a lot more. And I think people that have been able to stick around in the true crime genre have been able to see that. And I think if the police departments wanted to actually, you know, attempt to get answers, there needs to be some sort of, at some point, some ticking clock that says it's been 30 years. Or it's been 40 years. Let's try something different, something new, because people are people are dying. People are not are going to die. People that might have information, an ex-girlfriend or anything, and they're just not getting the information out there. So
I wanted to weigh in a little bit because your initial question, Billy, was kind of the media coverage of it. And I will say, I wasn't working in the media in 82 because I was one, but even covering sexual assault cases and pushing to get those covered, especially on TV, even until really like 2015, 2016, it was a hard pill for people to talk about. People did not want to discuss it. They did not want to do these cases because, one, the victim shouldn't be named, or the survivor shouldn't be named, depending on how they identify themselves. But on top of that, media in general didn't, and some still don't, know how to address that issue. Yeah. So I think that's another reason, because both of those 82 cases, the victim or survivor is still living. Mm-hmm. And that makes people very uncomfortable. So really until Me Too and even Nassar, I feel like to some degree, gave media the ability to discuss cases of sexual assault and sexual abuse with some dignity and grace that they didn't know how to do before that.
I think that's a good point. And we, and you know, in I'll Be Gone in the Dark, that was one of the not only from media, but even more from law enforcement and the justice system that we saw in I'll Be Gone in the Dark is how, you know, you would have certain individuals getting such small sentences for being convicted of sexual assaults. We were not taking anything seriously from the law enforcement perspective for a really, really long time. And as you know, me and Polly being in the producer's room and things like that, it's a hard sell. It still is a hard sell for to do sexual assault cases. It's gotten better though. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. That's one of my favorite things about podcasting is the fact that we get to pick the stories that we tell.
Yes.
And it's the three of us deciding which ones we want to tell. So we're able to give voices to people that maybe didn't have them before.
Absolutely. So Kathy wasn't the only unsolved murder from that area or time period. Now, Paul Haynes combed through the news archives and created a map of potentially similar cases. On it, in 1971, a young mother named Mary Condor was killed in the suburb of Naperville. Her husband had gone to work early that morning. Mary and her two-year-old son were home alone. The killer entered through the rear door of the house. He sexually assaulted her and stabbed her in the chest and stomach. There's also Christine Marie DeWitt, 14 years old. Her nude body was found in a Calumet City roadway. She'd been stabbed more than 15 times in the back, head, arms, and her throat had been slashed. Then in 1972, Julianne Hansen was riding her bike near her home in Naperville, and an offender abducted her. She was then raped and stabbed 30 times. Her alleged killer was recently identified with DNA and genetic genealogy at the beginning of this month, nearly 50 years later. And his name is Barry Lee Welpley, and he lived just a few miles from Hansen at the time of the murder. So, Paul Haynes, what stood out about these cases in relation to Kathy's?
Yeah, and what's remarkable about Julianne Hansen is that case was solved the day after I wrote it into the script. I don't know why more agencies aren't getting on board with forensic genealogy, and that's what I was going to ask Paul earlier. Do you have some insight into that?
You know, I actually do have some insight into that, and you know, part of a lot of it is dependent upon whether it be a local or state philosophy at this point in time. Or in some states where we actually see legislative actions that is preventing the use of genealogy. But there are politicians within any local jurisdiction that could weigh in and prevent law enforcement from pursuing something that they have a philosophical opposition to. And there's plenty of individuals in the political sphere that have issues with the use of genealogy on criminal cases. And they strongly influence those law enforcement agencies. Law enforcement, in my experience, if they are permitted to pursue a technology and they have the wherewithal, and that's an important wherewithal to know how to pursue the technology, they will, because they want to solve the case. But oftentimes there are external influences that prevent them from doing that. And that's where, you know, that is one of my primary concerns. We've seen Maryland, we've seen Montana pass some statewide laws that have restrictions on law enforcement's use of this technology. And the reality is that some of those restrictions are going to prevent families from getting answers as to who killed their loved ones. It's going to allow offenders to stay on the street. And some of these offenders are active. It's going to have other people being sexually assaulted or killed. And who are these people that are being sexually assaulted or killed by the offenders that are being caught with genealogy? It's predominantly women and children.
And I think the case that really validated a lot of these lawmakers' concerns that have problems with genetic genealogy or forensic genealogy, I prefer that one. It's like a battle between the two phrases. Some articles use forensic genealogy, some say genetic genealogy. But there was a church organist, an elderly woman, who was attacked while playing the organ alone in her church. And she was brutally beaten. And they found genetic material, forensic material at the scene. They used GEDmatch to identify the, it was a juvenile offender. GEDmatch had some issues with that. And I think they changed their, they automatically opted everyone out.
Yeah.
That
was right when they opted everyone out. Yeah.
That's the type of offender who will likely offend again and perhaps next time kill his victim. So it's crime prevention that's not quite Minority Report. It's crime prevention that it's a crime that's already occurred that exhibits a potential pattern of escalation.
No, the way I always say it is that, you talk about opt-in. The offender opted in when he made the offense and left his DNA at the scene.
Well said.
Yeah. The misperception out there, and I hate the term genetic genealogy. You know, that's something that was being used by the genealogists before we ever employed this technique within the Golden State Killer. And at no point, I, as a law enforcement officer, had access to anybody's genetic information in the genealogy databases. That's why that term is it's so misleading. All I see when I search a genealogy database is a list of individuals that share a percentage of their DNA with the person I'm looking for. It tells me how closely or distantly related they are, which sometimes, when you take a look at people's social media accounts, you are able to determine entire families based on what their postings are. This is what people generally will put out into the public. So the idea that, there's a privacy concern of the people in the database from a genetic standpoint is very, very misleading, or that they're going to become genetic witnesses and being pulled into court. In Golden State Killer, the people that we ultimately used to triangulate back to identify Joseph DeAngelo, they were considered to be anonymous tipsters. They are just generating a lead as if somebody called in on a tip line, chose to remain anonymous, and said, look over here. But the power of it, it's based on science. It's based on DNA. It focuses law enforcement's investigative efforts into the right area. In Golden State Killer, the use of this technology saved hundreds of men from law enforcement knocking on their door saying their name came up in the investigation because some ex-girlfriend or some ex-wife said they looked like a composite from the 1970s and we need a sample of your DNA. Under that circumstance, those men would have relinquished an actual DNA sample to the government, whereas this genealogy process, nobody in the database had their DNA sample or their DNA profile obtained by law enforcement, and it saved all these men from having that knock on the door. Legislators that are trying to prevent this from occurring don't understand traditional law enforcement investigative practices using traditional DNA techniques, where across the nation we are procuring actual DNA samples from private citizens and testing those samples, and now the government possesses their DNA. The genealogy process, you never possess anybody's DNA in the genealogy database. And if you end up going and doing what we call target testing, you think you're close and then you reach out to somebody and say, hey, we think you're related to somebody we're looking for. Will you voluntarily consent to give us a DNA sample? They have a mechanism to say, yes, I will consent. They sign a form, but I want my sample expunged. I want my sample destroyed. And there's legal processes that will ensure that that happens. So this is where it's so frustrating from my perspective when I see these restrictions starting to be put into place. And I'm going, you know what? For decades now, we've been utilizing DNA technology in which the government is seizing innocent people's DNA and then holding on to it. Whereas in the genealogy process, those people in the database, they're just merely starting data points to do genealogy, traditional genealogy using public source information.
So, yeah, the Julianne Hansen case was solved with forensic genealogy. And it's a case that has been revived periodically by the press. Whereas this other case that we referenced, Mary Condor, there were two articles in the Chicago Tribune in 1971. I think one reference to it and a roundup of unsolved crimes in 1979 in the Tribune. And there's no reference to it anywhere. I mean, there, I think there's our find a grave page for Mary Condor. So it's like, you know, why are some of these cases kept alive? Other cases are forgotten to time. And I think Michelle McNamara is one answer. She is someone that without Michelle, would we still be talking about Kathy Lombardo? Mm-hmm. Probably not.
Probably not. And just for a tally right now, we're at about 200 solves, not convictions, but solves since D'Angelo with genetic genealogy.
With forensic genealogy. Yeah.
So when we thought it was going to be more, you know, but we know that we had the floodgates had opened early. And we know that it's gotten down a little bit to a trickle. And one of the reasons why we do this podcast is to turn that fire hose back on.
There was another unsolved crime I found from 1993, which was the murder of a 22-year-old woman named Cynthia Joan Schemmler. I think it's Schemmler. It might be Kemmler. Schemmler was found stabbed to death off a jogging path in none other than the Thatcher Woods Forest Preserve, and that was on June 1st, 1993. And that was 9 years after Kathy Lombardo's death and 15 years after the Thatcher Woods jogger rapist series. So it's not known if Cynthia Schemmler was sexually assaulted and she was fully clothed when she was found. Mm-hmm. But that murder remains unsolved.
So bring it back to the Kathy Lombardo case. And you know, we spoke a lot about forensic genealogy. We do not know if they still have a sample from the killer. We do not know if the Oak Park Police Department is doing anything with that sample, trying to utilize forensic genealogy. We, of course, have an open invitation that we will pay for that if the Oak Park Police Department would be so inclined, give us a call. But as far as all of these other cases, particularly talking about the case of Grace, which ones do you think, Paul Haynes, are connected? Do you think we're with pretty decent certainty that Grace is connected to the Kathy case?
I would say more likely than not. I think the Grace Bichetti attack and the three other attacks in Oak Park in the fall of 1982 were likely connected to Kathy Lombardo's murder. I'm not so sure about any other crimes that are on the radar of this investigation or our episode. Then there's the question of what accounts for that gap between fall of 1982 and August of 1984. And this seems like a pretty impulsive offender. So we know that D'Angelo took some time off, and D'Angelo was a different type of offender. These attacks are more or less blitz attacks, opportunistic. Certainly, the offender may have set out with the intention of finding a victim, mm-hmm. but they don't seem terribly well planned.
No. Yeah. So, thankfully, you know, Kathy's case, and like you had said, Paul, we wouldn't be talking about it if not for Michelle. So, hopefully, somebody's going to come forward with information. There's still a lot that we don't know, particularly from the Oak Park Police Department. And currently, the producers of I'll Be Gone in the Dark and Kathy's brother Chris are suing to gain access to the case files and the forensic documents from the Oak Park Police Department. So we will keep you in the know with anything about any updates about that. And that gets
In Murder on Middle Beach, which is another HBO true crime docuseries, the agency that had been stonewalling that family, they were sued and the litigants were successful. they got the doc, which is very, very rare.
Yeah. No, it's great. Listen, like we always say on this podcast, get loud. And that's certainly what Michelle was trying to do. And that's what we're trying to do as well. And that gets us to our weekly assignment. So while we wait on the court's ruling on the case files, we wanted to get the word out about the case. You can see visuals of it in the new episode of All Begun in the Dark. But again, 24-year-old Kathy Lombardo left her apartment in the evening hours of Wednesday, August 1st, 1984. She liked going on evening walks. That night, she was walking near the White Hen in Oak Park when she was attacked. An offender pulls her into this alley. She's raped, stabbed in the heart, and slashed in the throat. If you know anything about this case or any of the other cases from that time frame, please, please contact us. That gets us to the rules. Don't name names in public. Don't do any side-by-sides. Don't dox each other and be nice. And now we get to the weekly distraction. Paul Haynes, do you have a distraction?
I was wearing a 24-hour Holter monitor because I've been having palpitations for like years. I've had a Holter monitor once before. And of course, there were no palpitations while I was wearing the Holter monitor. Same thing this time. And it's like the symptoms will hide when they know they're being monitored. And it's like being gaslit by your own body.
Yeah,
I know exactly what you're talking about because my daughter gets seizures and we've taken her to the hospital to put the contraption on her head so then they could do the brain waves for the seizures and she doesn't get a seizure. And that's happened three times. So I feel your pain there. Okay. Well, that's very much from the Paul Holes school of distractions.
You stole my thunder.
Paul Holes, what's been distracting you this week?
Well, you know, I'm in the process of trying to do some landscaping around my house, and the landscape that existed when we bought this house out front included a lot of what I just call as drain rock. You know, this 3/4-inch crushed rock that they just distribute across, you know, various planting areas. And, you know, I want to get some plants and get some, you know, nature going again out there instead of just having this rock preserve out front. And so I've been shoveling this rock and, you know, I've had to do this before, but oh my God, as I'm getting older, it's like this beats the hell out of my body. I have this 4-foot high pile of rock that I've piled on the side of the house and I'm dying here. You know, it's like, my God. So please, people, think about the next owners of your house. Don't just landscape with rock. You know, do something else. You know, save somebody's back in the future.
Okay. Mine is a little bit less painful. I went on a, you know, it was just Record Store Day. And, you know, we're both in our midlife crisis starting to collect more vinyl. I ordered something from there's a company. I love these subscription boxes. There you can get like, you can get a box with like a bunch of stuff and they surprise you with it. Well, there's one for vinyl.
Yeah.
And it's called Vinyl Me Please, I think it's called. And I got the first Doors album and they press it in 180, which is like a heavy plastic. And it's the first Doors album and it's gold. It's like a gold color, which is fantastic. Oh, wow. And they also included in it the single, the Light My Fire single from France. So it's just something cool digging into. I also bought the Jim Morrison collected works. A lot of people give Jim Morrison a lot of guff. I thought he was actually particularly good. And let me tell you something. If anybody published all of the writing that I did up until 27 without me editing it and this putting it in there, I would be horrified. There was going to be some bad stuff in there, but I think Jim Morrison had some pretty good stuff for somebody that just lived to 27 years old. So I am a big Doors fan. And so I've been on a bit of a Jim Morrison Doors kick up in the apartment right now. Well, thank you everybody for joining us. We are going to now be able to turn on the air conditioner, which, as many of you people don't understand, many of you might, but all your favorite podcasts are done in sweltering heat because we don't want the air conditioner messing up the sound. So I'm going to be very excited to turn on the air conditioner right now. Please subscribe, rate, review. That always helps us a lot. Paul Haynes, where can people find you on social media?
Paul of Haynes on Twitter and Instagram.
Okay.
Don't find me on Facebook, please.
Do not find Paul Haynes on Facebook. And you could find us on the Murder Squad. Follow me and Paul, etc. Go grab some merch. And until then, keep digging.
Keep digging.
And don't be an irony.
Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Paulie Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgara, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.